Hello, everyone. Now, normally I would say welcome to Homicide Hot Dish, but we actually decided to change our name to Homicide and Hot Dish. The reason behind it is we sort of felt that Homicide Hot Dish was a little gruesome or morbid sounding. So, welcome to Homicide and Hot Dish. I'm your host, Brittany. Today's recipe is another soup. I haven't been making much hot dish lately because I've just been stuck in soup mode. So this one is French onion soup. Now, unfortunately, if you dislike onions, you definitely want to skip this recipe because there are literally 6 whole onions in it. But if you do like onions, I suggest you give this recipe a try. It takes like 1 hour and 45 minutes to make, which is a very long time for me, but it takes about 1 hour just for the onions to caramelize, so it's not like you're literally standing there cooking for 1 hour and 45 minutes. So if you're interested, check out our Facebook and Instagram pages, both titled Homicide and Hot Dish, for that recipe. And now on to the homicide. Now, first of all, I want to give a disclaimer. In this episode, we will discuss some details involving sexual assaults of young boys. I'm talking around 11, 12 years of age, and the murder of a young boy as well. So please listen at your own discretion. Now, this case is one that all of Minnesota, and probably most of the United States actually, is all too familiar with. It involves an abduction and murder of an 11-year-old boy in rural Minnesota in 1989. It's a case that haunted Minnesotans for nearly 27 years. This is the murder of Jacob Wetterling. In 1986, Painesville, Minnesota was your typical, quiet, small rural town. The population was about 2,000 back then. And it was a very safe town where kids would ride their bikes outside of town in the country, down remote roads, they'd walk to the store. Parents didn't really think their children were in any danger. But if you were a boy around age 11 or 12, you were in possible danger. Between 1986 and 1988, the town of Painesville saw what police referred to as a cluster of assaults on young boys. According to a criminal complaint, there were a total of 8 different assaults on 7 boys. Yes, you heard me right, 8 assaults, 7 boys. One of those poor kids was assaulted twice. Now, these assaults involved a very similar pattern. Not only were they roughly in the same area of town, and the boys described the same characteristics of the perpetrator, but all the boys were around 12 years of age. Many of the boys all described their attacker as being a white man in his 30s, about 5'6 to 5'9, heavier set or like a pudgy build, and said that he was wearing a mask. All these assaults happened in public places, while the boys were walking home or just hanging outside with friends or riding their bikes. The assailant would attack them, knocking them off their bikes, and then try to grope their genitals, both over and under their clothing. A few of the times, the man would ask the boys their ages or what grade they were in, and he would sometimes threaten to kill the boys. In one attack that occurred on November 30th, 1986, he told a boy to, quote, "keep laying down or I'll blow your head off," end quote. In another attack that took place on February 14th, 1987, a boy and his friend were in a stairwell of an apartment building when one of the boys was assaulted. The man threw the boy down onto the stairs and the boy then screamed. The man told him to be quiet or he would kill him. He then asked the boy what grade he was in and groped his testicles and penis over and under his clothing. After that, he took the boy's wallet and left. Now, this poor boy had been through such a traumatic event, and just 3 months later, it happened to him again. According to the criminal complaint, on May 17, 1987, the boy was riding his bike in town, and the man knocked him off the bike. He again groped the boy's testicles, and the boy screams and tells him, "What are you doing? You already got me." The man then fled on foot, and in the process, he ended up dropping the baseball cap he was wearing. The cap was handed over to the police, and the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension Crime Lab tested it. They found that the cap contained DNA from three or more individuals, so most likely one of those individuals is the boy who was attacked. But who were the others? Now, unfortunately, that's not the last of these attacks on young boys in the area. According to the criminal complaint, on January 13, 1989, a 12-year-old boy named Jared Shirell was kidnapped and sexually assaulted in Cold Spring, Minnesota, which is about 15 or 20 minutes from Painesville, where those other attacks occurred. According to In the Dark, Jared went ice skating with some friends that day. Afterwards, they went to a cafe, and then most of the kids got rides home from their parents. But Jared and his friend, Corey Eskelson, walked home instead. This was around 9 p.m., and the two boys live in opposite directions from each other, so they split up when it was time. As Jared was walking, a man in a blue car pulls up next to him. The man asked him something like, "Hey, do you know where so-and-so lives?" or something like that. I believe he just made up a random name. As Jared started to respond, the man got out of the car, grabbed him, and told him to get in the car. He forced Jared into the back seat and started to drive. While they were driving, Jared noticed a handheld walkie-talkie radio on the passenger seat. The man must have seen him eyeing it and told him, "I have a gun and I'm not afraid to use it. Don't try anything stupid." After about 15 minutes of driving, the man stops on a gravel road. He then gets into the back seat and tells Jared to take off his snowmobile suit and to pull his pants and underwear down. Jared, obviously probably afraid, does what he's told. The man then sexually assaults Jared, and after that, he climbs from the back seat into the driver's seat and he gives Jared his snowmobile suit back, but he keeps his pants and underwear, I suppose as a souvenir. He turns to Jared and says, "You're lucky to be alive, and if the police find out about this, I'll find you after school and kill you." He then drives back towards Cold Spring and lets Jared go, about 2 miles from Jared's house. But before driving off, he says, "Don't look back or I'll shoot you." According to the episode of In the Dark, Jared would have nightmares constantly after his attack, and the day after it happened, he didn't go to school, which I don't think is surprising. Remember, Jared was walking home with his friend Corey when they split up. Well, the next day, Corey didn't know why Jared wasn't in school. He had no idea what had happened to him, and that day, FBI agents came into Corey's classroom. And they asked Corey for his hat. They didn't say why they wanted it, but he gave it to them anyway. He later found out that Jared had told investigators that the man who kidnapped him had worn a hat that looked like Corey's. Now, you would think, at least I would like to think, that investigators would have maybe talked to Corey more, like about the night that his best friend was kidnapped and assaulted. But when Corey was interviewed for this article of In the Dark about 5 years ago, he says the FBI didn't even ask him anything. He says, quote, "Nobody's asked me a single question about this other than you guys. I've never been interviewed by police. I've never been talked to by any law enforcement ever. Not one person," end quote. Looking back, this was, in many people's opinion, the first mistake made. Now back to Jared's attack. He describes the man to authorities and he says the guy's shorter, maybe 5'6 or so, about 170 pounds, which again matches the height and build of the man responsible for those Painesville attacks. And Jared says the man wore military-style camouflage clothing. Jared says he's got a deep, raspy voice and he drove a blue car. Now, something very smart that Jared did when the man was driving him around was Jared actually paid attention and tried to remember every turn they took. Now, remember, it was dark out, so he couldn't really see. He remembered if they went over railroad tracks. He remembered when they weren't on pavement anymore and when they turned on a gravel road. Very smart for a young kid and very helpful to investigators. Investigators actually took Jared for a ride to see if he'd remember where the man took him. They had him lie down in the back seat of one of their cars and cover his eyes. Jared ended up directing them to a spot between Cold Spring, again where Jared lives, and the town of Painesville, again where those other attacks took place. Just 3 days after Jared's attack, a deputy with the Stearns County Sheriff's Office comes up with a possible suspect. 25-year-old Danny Heinrich, who just so happens to be from Painesville. He's about 5'5", stocky build, and he happens to drive a blue car. Now, with these attacks that happened in Painesville, Jared and his family members weren't even made aware of those attacks, which again happened from 1986 up until the year prior to Jared's assault in 1989. So Jared didn't know that there were other boys attacked just like he was, only about 15 minutes away. Another mistake made. But one thing law enforcement did do, now that they had Danny Heinrich as a possible suspect, was put together a lineup. The lineup consisted of Danny Heinrich along with other men for Jared to see if he could identify one of them as being his attacker. Jared ended up picking out two of the men that he thought resembled the man who attacked him. One of those men was Danny Heinrich. Now, myself along with others would think that maybe they would show this lineup to the boys of Painesville, you know, the ones who were attacked there. But they don't. So there's another mistake. The day after Jared picked out two of those men from the lineup, detectives find Heinrich's car parked outside of his work. Jared told investigators that the car had a luggage rack and that it had blue interior, but Heinrich's car does not have a luggage rack, and the inside of the car was more gray than blue. But, I mean, it was dark out when this happened. Jared maybe thought he saw a luggage rack, or maybe Heinrich even removed it. And gray, in my opinion, can be pretty dang close to blue, especially in the dark. But either way, Heinrich is not charged for the attack, and neither is anyone else. And then, 9 months later, an even more horrible attack happens to a young boy. According to the Twin Cities Pioneer Press, the night of Sunday, October 22, 1989, Patty and Jerry Wetterling were at a friend's house for a party about 20 minutes from their home in St. Joseph, Minnesota. Their oldest child, Amy, was at a sleepover, so they asked their son, Jacob, who was 11, to watch his 10-year-old brother, Trevor, and 8-year-old sister, Carmen, while they were gone. The kids didn't have school the next day, so Jacob called his parents when they were at the party, and he asked them if he could have his friend, Aaron, come over. His parents said that was fine, and when Aaron got there, the boys decided they wanted to rent a movie. Now again, this is 1989, you can't just download a movie on your smart TV. According to an episode of The Hunt with John Walsh, Trevor called their mom Patty and asked if he, Jacob, and their friend Aaron can ride their bikes to the convenience store in town to rent a movie, which is maybe a mile away or so. They live on the outskirts of town and there's basically nothing between their house and the store really, mostly just farm fields and a few houses. It was starting to get dark though, so Patty tells the boys, no, just find something else to do. And Trevor says, let me just talk to Dad, which is pretty typical of a child to do when one parent says no. And their dad, Jerry, says he's really got no concerns about the boys going besides a long stretch of road where there would be traffic. That was his only worry, that there would be traffic. But Jerry says, okay, fine, go get the movie, but come straight home. The next door neighbor girl, Rochelle Jerzak, comes over to watch their little sister Carmen, while Jacob, his brother Trevor, and their friend Aaron all get on their bikes to head to the convenience store. The boys rented the movie The Naked Gun and then headed back for home. But they don't make it back home, not all of them anyway. When they were about a half mile away, a man suddenly appears out of the darkness. Back at the Wetterling home, Rochelle, again the next door girl and babysitter, is watching TV when Trevor and Aaron come running in the house screaming, "Someone took Jacob. There was a man with a gun and he took Jacob." According to the episode of The Hunt, a man wearing a mask came out of nowhere and stopped the boys on the road, again just about a half mile from the Wetterling home, and he was carrying a handgun. He told the kids to get off their bikes and lay down in the ditch or he would shoot them. He asked them one by one what their age was. Now doesn't that sound familiar? What's your age? What grade are you in? After that, he told Trevor to run off into the nearby woods, and then he told Aaron to do the same. He told them not to look back or he would shoot them. Now doesn't that also sound familiar? When the man who attacked Jared let him go, he told him not to look back or he'd shoot him. As their friend Aaron started to run, he saw the man grab Jacob's arm and pick him up off the ground. Patty Wetterling says of Aaron, quote, "When he caught up to Trevor and they felt safe enough to turn around and look back, they were gone. They were just gone," end quote. According to the episode of In the Dark, the babysitter, Rochelle, was terrified and says, quote, "I didn't know what to do. The first thing I did was pick up the phone and call my dad and had him come right over," end quote. Rochelle's dad, Merlin Jerzak, immediately calls Jacob's parents. According to the episode of The Hunt with John Walsh, Jerry answers, and Merlin says, quote, "Jerry, you have to leave that party right now and come home," end quote. Jerry went back to the table and said to Patty, "We have to go. Somebody took Jacob." Patty says she just grabbed her purse and they left. They didn't say anything to their friends. They just ran out the door. Patty says that car ride home was the longest ride in the world. After Merlin talked to the Wetterlings, he called 911, and all this is between 9 and 9:30 at night. And when he makes the 911 call, Jacob had been missing for about 15 minutes at that point. Now, 15 minutes doesn't seem like a very long time, but when someone is missing, especially a child, it is a very long time. Robert Lowry Jr., who is the vice president of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, says, quote, "When it comes to missing children, time is the enemy. Seconds count. Hours count. If that child is going to be killed, it's going to happen within the first few hours," end quote. In Merlin's 911 call, he tells the dispatcher that he is calling from the Wetterling home. He says the boys went to the Tom Thumb convenience store to get a movie, and on their way back, someone stopped them. And he says he believes that the person has one of the boys, Jacob, because he did not come back with the other two boys. The dispatcher asks if Jacob was picked up in a vehicle. Merlin then asks the boys if there was a vehicle, but they say no. The man just appeared on the road on foot and he was wearing a mask. The dispatcher says a squad car is on their way to the Wetterling house, and then she asks him what Jacob was wearing. He says he was wearing a red hockey jacket that had Wetterling written on it. Merlin then asks Jacob's brother Trevor to come to the phone to speak to the dispatcher so he can better describe what he saw. And I'm going to play part of this conversation with the dispatcher now.
I'm ready.
Okay, I'll put Trevor on.
Okay.
And he can answer your question. We've got him pretty well calmed down here.
Hello? Trevor? Well, you're talking to the sheriff's office. I want you to give me anything you can recall about this male party that approached you guys.
Well, he was like a man. Sort of big.
He was large?
Sort of.
Okay.
And he has it looks sort of like nylon things as a mask.
Do you know what color it was?
Black.
A black mask? Do you know what color jacket he had on?
Black too.
Did you notice any jeans or anything?
Yeah.
Trevor, do you know what happened to your friend's bicycle?
No, we don't know.
Nobody knows what happened to that.
Because we had to just, run off into the woods.
Okay, you guys ran off into the woods, but nobody knows what happened to Jacob, right?
Yeah.
Can you think of anything else that the guy has?
That what?
Does the guy have a deep voice, anything like that
yeah.
you can remember? Can you tell me how big, compared to your dad or somebody, how big would you say this guy was?
He was about the size of Merle, the guy that you just talked to.
Okay, same height, same weight,
yeah,
that type of thing? And he had on a black mask and a black jacket. Do you know if the jacket was leather or a nylon? Did it have anything written on it?
We couldn't tell because it was so dark.
Can I talk to Merlin again real quick?
Yep.
Merlin, how big are you?
Okay, I'm about 195 pounds,
uh-huh.
5'10".
I know, that's hard for kids to pinpoint, so I have to try to figure out who he looks like. I'm hoping if Jacob would have ran into the woods or something, if he would have gotten lost or something, do they know if he actually had contact with Jacob?
Yes, they just told me that the guy got a hold of Jacob and told them to run into the woods. Told the other two boys to run into the woods.
Did they see any weapons at all or anything like that?
Yeah.
Guns, knives?
He had a pistol.
Now, after about this point here, the first officer arrives at the Wetterling home. It's Deputy Bruce Bechtold. He asks the boys to go with him so they can show him the spot where Jacob was kidnapped. But the boys were just too terrified. So Merlin says, "How about I go with?" And the boys agree. Now, at this same time, remember, Patty and Jerry Wetterling are racing back home from their friend's house. According to the episode of In the Dark, Jerry is driving and Patty is pushing him, saying, "Drive faster, drive faster." She says, quote, "In my mind, he was going 10 miles an hour and I'm like, speed, hurry up. He said he didn't want to get stopped by the police. I said, well, we'd have a police escort, so just drive," end quote. When Patty and Jerry arrive at their home, the deputy, the boys, and Merlin were still there. Trevor and Aaron were very obviously still shaken. Trevor was just talking nonstop, telling them every single thing that happened and everything that he could remember. But Aaron, again Jacob's best friend, just stood in the corner biting his nails. Patty says of Aaron, quote, "It was like he wanted to disappear," end quote. Now, sometimes kids will be kids and they can sometimes try to play pranks that aren't funny or even end up doing something they're not supposed to and just try to hide it. So investigators needed to first make sure that this wasn't some sort of joke or prank and that this really did happen. They sit the boys down at the kitchen table and they ask the boys questions like, "Are you sure you weren't just playing with a gun and Jacob got hurt and you're afraid to tell?" Or, "Are you sure Jacob just didn't run away?" And the boys are adamant that, "No, this is not a joke. Jacob's gone. A man with a gun took him." The investigators working on the case are from the Stearns County Sheriff's Office, which St. Joseph is in Stearns County. The sheriff is 62-year-old Charlie Graft. He gets to the crime scene around 10 p.m., about an hour or so after Jacob disappeared. And about 45 minutes later, there were volunteers from the local fire department out helping search for Jacob. They checked out the woods nearby where Trevor and Aaron had ran to. They had thought that maybe the man and Jacob were in the woods. A helicopter with a spotlight was even called in to look for Jacob. But there was no sign of him or the man that took him. They did find shoe prints on the gravel where the boys were, though. One print seemed to be from an adult, and the other from a child or a smaller adult. They also found tire tracks near the shoe prints. Now, remember, according to Trevor and Aaron, the man that approached them was on foot. He wasn't in a car at the time. But the only thing that made sense was that this man did have a vehicle, and that's how he got away so quickly with Jacob. Now, the crime scene, or spot where Jacob was kidnapped, ends up being right at the end of a man's driveway. The man is 33-year-old Dan Rassier. Since the boys told officers that they never saw a car, they only saw a man on foot, that made officers believe that the man could possibly live nearby. And one thing I know probably put Dan Rassier on police radar was his driveway. Remember, the crime scene is at the end of his driveway. So the main road, the road that Jacob was abducted on, is connected to the end of Dan's driveway. So his driveway comes to a T with this road. And we did share a sort of map layout on our Facebook and Instagram pages for you to reference as well. According to APM reports, Dan shared the house with his parents, but they were away traveling, so he was alone the day Jacob was abducted. At some point, Dan says he remembers looking out the window because something caught his eye. He said he saw a tan Monte Carlo type car that was going very fast up his driveway. Now, you can't see Dan's house from the main road, again, the road that Jacob was abducted on, so he says sometimes people would drive up his driveway, not realizing it's just a driveway, it's not a through road. Dan says, quote, "This car zooms in and is driving insanely fast, does a fishtail, blows out of the yard. I go from my room to the other side of the house and watch the car zoom up the hill and go, what was that about?" End quote. He says the car was going 60 or 70 miles an hour and, quote, "This car is on a mission from hell to do something," end quote. Dan sort of goes on with the rest of his day and puts the car in the back of his mind. But then something strange happens again. Later that night, he hears his dog barking. He looks out the window again and sees another car, but this one is smaller and darker in color. It's driving fast up his driveway and then turns around the same way the other car had. He thought it was definitely strange, but again, sort of put it in the back of his mind and goes to bed. He says the next thing he remembers is his dog barking again. He looks outside once more, but this time he sees flashlights moving around near his family's woodpile outside. He assumes it's trespassers trying to steal stuff, so he calls 911, and this is at about 10:45 at night. The 911 dispatcher tells him about the boy that's been abducted. So this is about a little over an hour and a half since Jacob's been missing. Dan then goes outside and speaks with the sheriff's deputy, and he looks around his property a little bit, sort of helping them search, and then goes back inside his house. They end up not finding any clues or anything at all on Dan's property, but they don't just leave it at that. Dan worked as a band and music teacher at the school, and the morning after Jacob's abduction, police showed up at the school to talk with him. According to APM reports, they looked at the tires of his car and looked in his trunk, but find nothing. They end up leaving after not finding anything, but they still keep Dan on their radar. So that morning, the morning after Jacob was abducted, the entire town of St. Joseph knew about it. It shook the whole community. And to this day, so many people remember where they were, what they were doing, and how they discovered that Jacob was missing. According to the episode of In the Dark, a resident named Hope Clocker said she and her husband were laying in bed when they heard it on the radio. She says, quote, "We sat up in bed and were like, Jacob? And of course, then we raced, got dressed, and got going right over to the Wetterlings," end quote. According to APM reports, on October 24, 1989, at 3:40 p.m., a local high school sophomore and his father go to the Stearns County Sheriff's Office. They ask to meet with an investigator. The boy tells the investigator about the at least eight that we know of, assaults in the nearby town of Painesville, which again is only like 15 minutes from St. Joseph. You would think, or I would like to think anyway, that investigators would have known about the Painesville attacks when they were looking into Jacob's disappearance, but apparently they didn't know. And the boy tells them that he actually witnessed two of the Painesville assaults. He says a man grabbed these two boys off their bikes and then threatened them with a knife. He says the way this man acted makes him think that it's actually the same person who took Jacob. The boy and his father plead with them and urge them to talk with the Painesville Police Department, who were aware of those attacks in their own town. They need to get a move on, but they don't. They don't bother with speaking to the Painesville Police Department, at least not yet anyway. Now, why they didn't immediately jump on this lead, I have no idea, and I think many people questioned it. On October 25th, 1989, 3 days after Jacob disappeared, a prayer vigil was held at the St. Joseph Church where over 500 people attended. Sheriff Graff says they're sure it was a sex offender who took Jacob, and he thinks that the abductor has likely left the area and even suggests that Jacob could be dead. On October 26, 1989, 4 days after Jacob disappeared, an episode of A Current Affair is released with Mari Povich as the host. Yes, that Mari, the "you are not the father" Mari. In the episode, Patty pleads for Jacob's safe return. She says, quote, "This shouldn't happen anywhere. It's the type of, it shouldn't happen anywhere. All I could think was who? Who would take a child away from their parents? I couldn't fathom it," end quote. Jacob's father, Jerry, says, quote, "It is total shock, total disbelief. Even in talking with the sheriff's department here, they seem to be as amazed as we are," end quote. Patty then says, quote, "We taught him that people are good. We've worked for peace all our lives, and this is a real violent act, and I don't understand it. He's bright. He's got a real clever sense of humor and quick mind. He plays goalie. He's cool under pressure. All these things give me hope that there's an opportunity this boy will come home. He's a survivor," end quote. During the episode, Aaron and Trevor walk along the road where Jacob was abducted, and Aaron tells of what happened the night Jacob was taken. Aaron says, quote, "We were coming down this road here, and we were just talking and everything, and then this guy, he just came out and had a gun, and it didn't, I thought it was some kid pulling a prank or something, and then but it wasn't. He looked at Trevor, and he told Trevor to turn off his flashlight, and then he told us he had a gun, and he told us to turn around and go over into this ditch and put our bikes in there and lay down. Then he came over and he asked us all our ages, and then he told Trevor to run as fast as he could into the woods or else he'd shoot. Then he looked at me and he grabbed Jacob, and he told me to run as fast as I could into the woods or he'd shoot, end quote. The reporter asks, what did this man look like? And Aaron says he was in all black and had a mask on. You couldn't see his face. The reporter says, did Jacob say anything to the man? Aaron says, no, he just told him his age. The reporter asks Aaron if he looked back when he ran. And Aaron points to a nearby area and says, quote, yeah, once we got way down there, end quote. The reporter asks him what he saw when he looked back. And Aaron says, quote, nothing. He wasn't there anymore, end quote. Now again, this is just 4 days after Jacob's disappearance, and authorities at this point have received over 300 tips. So far, none of them have led to Jacob, but they are hopeful that Jacob will come home alive.